Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
So how many of y'all ready to turn the page and move on to the new year? Anybody? That's kind of what I like about this time of year. It's a time to sort of start over. Everybody needs a fresh start at some point. If last year was great for you, you can build on that into what's going to the next year. If last year wasn't everything you thought it would be, that's all right. You can just turn the page and move on into somewhere new. And so last year we talked about starting new habits for the year and how the habits make you. This year I just kind of want to talk about how do we kind of move on from the past? How do we kind of put the past behind us and leave it behind us and move into a new future? And to do that, we're going to be kind of starting off this morning talking about the sort of process of change, and then we'll get into a couple of things that we may want to change or put behind us. I start off with that clip from The Breakup. It's the movie always stood out to me because there's a lot of scenes in there that I just really identify with, especially the fact that he hates doing paperwork and receipts. That's me. If you behind the scenes, I'm horrible with that. I mean, everybody on staff knows I'm not good with this stuff. It's just don't let me anywhere near money because I don't like to do all the record keeping and bookkeeping for it. When we go somewhere, we need to purchase something, I'm always looking at Chris like, you do the purchasing. That way you can turn in the receipt. That's why I love Home Depot, because they automatically send the receipt to Sherry so she can, you know, check up on that. It's wonderful in that sense. And I've been there in those moments where when Vince Vaughn plays a part of a guy named Gary in the movie, and when he's like, I'm the talent, I'm what they all come to see, don't ask me to do this stuff. I would never say that. But you know, when you get so self-focused, you'll think a lot of things you would never say, and it just kind of comes out. And the movie identifies with a lot of us just because if you can't see yourself as that person, I'm sure you know somebody who's like that, who they just won't do what they need to get done, whether it be at home, they won't do the stuff that they need to get done around the house, or it could be at work, it could be on your team, and you rack your brain asking yourself, what can I do to get this person to see things and understand what they got to do? And so you go and you try to ask, and that's what happens right there at the truck. He tries to ask, hey, can you get this done? I really need you to get it done. And it's pretty much like, hey, I got a lot going on here. Can't you just see what I've got going on? And then he just drives off. So we talk about what you got going on. So he sits down and says, all right, well, tell me what's going on. Tell us what's going on. He says, all right, I understand that, but can you understand from my perspective, when you don't do this, it takes time away from my family. Can you get this done? That doesn't work. And so it goes on, and you go, and you go, and you go, and they just won't see it, and there's blow-ups. One of the guys just keeps on saying, he's so self-focused, he just keeps saying, can't you see it from my perspective? I've got a lot going on right now. I can't do this. Thanks for the talk. Thanks for the heartwarming. Don't you understand? I got a lot going on. This isn't a big deal to me. And so on and so forth. And it never gets anywhere. It never gets through. And there has to be a change. And then finally, of course, that change happens. Well, the movie doesn't go on long enough to know whether that's a lasting change or not. But somebody taking pictures over here? Is that the light up there? Which is it? Oh, I thought y'all were taking pictures. All right, never mind. Sorry. So the question, of course, how does change happen? How does lasting change happen? In the Bible, there's three elements to lasting change. This isn't necessarily an ordered list, but every time you see change come up, you'll see one of these three things come up, and all three are present when there's lasting change. And they can happen in any order. One is there's a decision. I'm going to decide. I have decided to follow Jesus. I've decided I'm going to make a change. I've decided I'm going to start going to Celebrate Recovery. I've decided enough is enough. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. There's always a decision somewhere in there that happens. Second of all, there is a change from the inside. There is a different motivation. There's something that comes out that redirects somebody to change the way they see something. And then thirdly, right along with it, is they're captivated by Jesus. They're enthralled by that. This is there's this greater love that is now motivating them. This is akin to you've got a teenager, and for years you've been asking them, you need to take a shower because you stink, you need to brush your teeth because it's just not hygienic, and on and on and on you go. And then all of a sudden, one day, they're taking showers at night, taking showers in the morning, they're putting on deodorant, they're brushing their teeth, and you ask them, did you brush your teeth? They're like, of course. As a matter of fact, I brought my toothbrush and toothpaste with me. I'm going to brush after lunch at school. And you're like, we're finally getting through to him. No, you know. There's a greater love now in their life. And so that love motivates and moves. The problem is, what happens once no longer likes her anymore, or now video games are more important than the girl? They go right back to where they were. That's why if it's going to be a lasting change, it's got to be a love motivated by something greater than just that thing or a temporary fling kind of thing. It's got to be something that is eternally there, and that's the greater love of Jesus Christ. So I chose Ephesians 4 this morning to kind of look through this just because in Ephesians 4, you see all three of these elements kind of succinctly put out in here, kind of all wrapped up, and how they work together is put very eloquently. Not that the Apostle Paul needs my compliment for how he wrote, but it really is kind of eloquently the way he puts this together here in Ephesians 4 on the process of change. And he says, so I tell you this, is Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17. So I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord. And I'm going to be breaking down like every word in here. So if you want to look it up in your YouVersion or one of those paper things, that's great. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17. He says, I tell you this and insist on the Lord. You must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They're darkened in their understanding and separated from the love or from the life of God. And because of their ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts, they've lost all sensitivity. They've given themselves over to all kinds of every indulgence from their sensuality, every kind of impurity, and they're given over to full greed. And that, however, is not the way of life that you learned when you heard about Jesus Christ. And you were taught in him according to the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to your former life to put off that old self, which is being corrupted by its evil or deceitful desires, and be made new in your attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. Now, the very first line of this is kind of funny, if you will, when he says, don't act like Gentiles anymore. If you go back to Ephesians chapter 2, you'll see that he's writing this letter to Gentiles. So it's like he's starting off writing this saying, hey, don't act like you live in Virginia Beach, all right? You're like, but I do live in Virginia Beach. Yeah, but just don't act like it, but I do. So what does he mean when he says, quit acting like Gentiles? Now, in biblical terms, there was, you know, in this category, there was Jews and there was Gentiles. The main distinction is Gentile way of thinking is our way of thinking. It is American culture. It's the culture that basically says, I can do what I want. It's well summarized by the poem Invictus. Anybody heard the poem Invictus? Maybe you'll recognize a few of the lines from it. He says, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged the punishments to the scroll, I am the master of my fate. I am the, anybody? Captain of my soul. Anybody heard that before? Yeah, I need to dumb things down a little bit better. Okay, so in the movie Dumb and Dumber, he says that, no, I'm kidding. But that summarizes up our mindset. That is our music. That is our culture. Sinatra said it, what? He said, I did it my way, right? It's all about me. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. You do what you're going to do, and that's kind of pretty much our mindset. That is the, when he's talking about the Gentile mindset, that's what he's talking about, the mindset that says, I'm the captain of my fate. I'm the master of my soul. Nobody can tell me what to do. Nobody can tell me what's right and wrong. I'm the judge, and I judge fairly, and if you don't realize the fairness of my judgment, well, that's because you see things from a skewed perspective, and you're the one who has a problem, not me. That is the way we are conditioned to think. That is what our culture tells us. We love movies where somebody takes matters into their own hands, right? And don't you love it? They go and they blow up an entire city in this chase or pursuit to get somebody, and the cops never hold them accountable. They're just like, oh, all right, what do you need next from us? There's no accountability there. You just go shoot 12 people. Nobody asks any questions. They're just happy that it happened. Well, that's what would happen if I was running things, right? I would take out the people. Why is it that we love the movie The Purge, that whole series? What if you could just do whatever you wanted to do for one day? I mean, we make movies about this. Some of you are like, I've never seen that movie. That doesn't sound like a title that would appeal to me. Whatever is your fancy, there is a movie out there catering towards You can be whoever you want to be. You can do whatever you want to do. It's the music that you listen to it, to whether it be... I did a thing on this a couple years back. I played a whole bunch of different, you know, clips of music, and every single one of them was all about, I'm going to rebel and do my own thing. Do y'all remember some of that? It's about 2 years ago, I think that was. It's our music. It's our culture. It's poems like this. It's I'm going to do whatever I'm going to do. So when he says... You got to quit thinking like a Gentile. What he's saying is you've got to quit thinking like the culture around you thinks, which is you're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. You get to decide where your ship is going to go, and nobody can tell you any different. And he says the problem is this way of thinking is futile. He says quit acting like Gentiles or thinking like Gentiles and the futility of their thinking. What he's saying basically, if you're going to think like this, futility is that which is incapable of producing the desired result. A futile effort, a futile thought. It is incapable of producing the desired result. So your desired result, let's just say you want to have a good marriage. Well, if you continue to think, I'm the captain of my fate, I'm the master of my soul, I get to do whatever I want, I call the shots, I determine what is right and wrong, I'm the one who's a fair judge for all this, it's going to be futile in having a good marriage. It's going to be futile in being successful in your job. It's going to be futile in as far as you want to be liked by people. That doesn't really build and influence friendships very well. You want to be known as a good person, a kind person, a loving person. This mindset that is, I'm the captain of my fate, I'm the master of my soul, is futile in getting you to that end. It doesn't get you there. It is incapable of producing that kind of result. Why? He says, because you're darkened in your way of thinking. The whole process is darkened. It's darkness is why I don't like this time of year. It is impossible to get anything done after 5 o'clock. Have you noticed that? It's like it gets dark out, and there's a part of you that says, it's only 5 o'clock. I got stuff I got to get done. But there's another part of you that says, yeah, but looks like it's time to get in bed. And then you fight it, and you go out there and do it anyway. So I'm out there trying to get some stuff done in my car this week, and like I drop a screw on the ground, and you can't find it. After a while, your mouth gets tired from holding the flashlight. No. I know there's magnetic flashlights and clip flashlights, but none of those flashlights continually put the light right where I want it. So you're like, doing it just so you can see, right? Because the problem with darkness is you can't see what's there. It's not that the screw just magically disappeared. It's there. It was there the whole time. You just couldn't see it. And this way of thinking takes things that are there that are plain to see, but you just can't see it. You're darkened in your mindset, your process. Other people can see it. You just can't see it. And so it's there. You just can't see it. It says they're darkened in their understanding. And it says they're separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. The hardening is where somebody points out, shines a light on it, and says, hey, I need these reports. This is a part of your job. You've got to do this. What does a hard heart look like? What kind of response does he get when he asks them for the reports? Drives off and blows it off, right? The second round, the hardening looks like what? A blowout argument. Yelling at him. His friend then points out to him the very same thing. Now, if you watch the movie, what ends up happening? His girlfriend points this out to him. His brother, who's his business partner, points it out to him. And his friend points it out to him at the bar. I just showed you his brother and his friend at the bar. And even when his friend mentions that, I cut a whole bunch out, partly because of language, partly because of time. But in there, he doesn't react very well. You saw a little bit of that. He's like, what are you talking about? What do you mean I'm only about myself? And his friend kind of lays it out for him, and he doesn't want to agree with it, that the hardening of the heart says, no, you're wrong, and insists, even if the whole world keeps pointing it out, I will insist that I am the captain of fate, I am the master of my soul. Whatever gods may be can't tell me what to do. I'll thank them, but they're not going to be in control of me. And so he says the hardening of the hearts. And what does it do? It says it leads them to give themselves over to sensuality and to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they are full of greed. The sensuality basically just says gratify yourself in the moment. Do whatever you feel, whatever your body says is what you need right now. If it's food, if it's sex, if it's entertainment, whatever it is that you want, do it. Now, tell me if there's a marketing slogan geared towards this lifestyle. All of them are geared towards that, right? I mean, every single marketing slogan is geared towards, hey, you've got needs, we will fill them. Gratify your senses, come give us your money. And so it's gratify your senses, and then the other one is greed. Greed is where it's not trying to consume it, it's just trying to collect it. And what does greed do? It tries to collect as much assets or as many assets as it possibly can, because that gives you control and power. To what? be able to go and gratify whatever need or sensibility you have later on down the road. If I consume and consume every resource out there, whenever I want to indulge my senses, I can do that because of what I've been greedy for. So they feed into each other. So this thing that says, I'm the captain of fate, I'm the master of my soul, it comes out. Anybody remember the movie Little Shop of Horrors? Anybody? What does the Venus flytrap keep saying? Feed me, Seymour, feed me. Feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. That is what your soul cries out to you constantly, telling you, feed me, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more, give me more. And whenever somebody else comes in and says, hey, this is something you need to do for somebody else, what's the answer? No. No, because life revolves around me, and it's all about feed me more. And so this is what it's like. He says, you got to quit thinking like this. It's futile in this thinking. But everybody around you in your culture is thinking like this. I get that. And I know that you're immersed in this culture, but you got to quit thinking like your culture because it's not going to get you where you want to end up going. It is futile. It is incapable of producing that desired result. So what do you need to do? He says, this isn't the way of life you learned when you heard about Christ. This is totally opposite of everything you see in Christ, that you were taught in accordance with him the truth that is in Jesus. It says, in regard to your former way of life, he says, to put off your old self, which is corrupted by all these deceitful desires, and be made new in the attitude of your minds, is then put on your new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And so he says there, put off, put on. This is that decision. You've got to decide for yourself to put off and to put on. That's why the whole put off, put on, this was used a lot in Greek metaphors. And of course, the idea is you're putting off clothes, putting on clothes. And the metaphor that was often used in Greek literature was, of course, to put off a virtue and then to take on the opposite virtue, sort of to put off hate but then put on love, to put off revenge and to put on forgiveness, that kind of thing. So it was always used of virtues. Paul here uses it, though, in a term that was never used by the Greeks. He says to put on a new self, to put off the old identity and put on a new identity, put on a new self, that it'd be a change of who you are. And this is a decision that you have to make. And I'll go back to what the Gentile world is all about. The Gentile world is all about, this life is all about what? Me. I'm the captain of my fate. I'm the master of my soul. Now, I acknowledge there's a God. I'll thank whatever gods there may be. But at the end of the day, I'm the captain of my fate. I'm the master of my soul. This life is about me. And he says, you've got to make a decision of what life is really all about. Is it about you, or is it about the one who created you? Now, I remember hearing this put very well several years ago. If the distance between the earth and the sun, which is how long? Anybody know distance? I heard 93 million. Who knew that? All right, 93 million miles is the distance between the earth and the sun. Just picture this paper represents 93 million miles, the distance from the earth and the sun. Then the distance between the earth and the nearest star is a stack of papers. You just stack these papers up from here up to about 2 1/3 times the height of the ceiling. So just take that. Every one of those pieces of paper represents 93 million miles. That stack, you know, double the size of the ceiling, a little bit more, would be the distance to our nearest star in our galaxy, right? Now, the distance to the end of our galaxy would be to take that paper, stack it up 310 miles high, okay? That'd be the distance to the end of our galaxy. Our galaxy in the universe is just one of billions upon billions of galaxies. They did astronomers took the telescope asking the question, what's in the empty space that you see? When you look up and you see the stars in the sky, what's in like the dark space? And so they tried to find the darkest place where there was the fewest amount of stars, where they could get the least amount of, you know, ambient light from our own galaxy in that picture. And they shot out as far as they could possibly go, I think it was with a Hubble telescope, to see what is it that they could see when they looked out there. And what they saw when they magnified it up was, and the size of what would be your thumb covering up if you went like this, estimated to be a billion galaxies just in that one corner of the universe. Just let that sink in for a minute. So we are a planet. Millions upon millions of miles away from the nearest star, millions upon millions of miles away from the end of our own galaxy, and we are just one galaxy in the midst of billions of galaxies within billions upon billions of galaxies in the universe. Now, if you go over to Hebrews 1, it says that God not only created the entire universe, but he holds the universe together by the power of his word. And here was the question. Does that sound like somebody you would invite to come and be your assistant? To be your co-pilot? Or is that somebody that you should give your life to? What is your life really all about? Are you thanking whatever gods there may be, or do you understand and recognize that there is a God who created the entire universe, which is far beyond your comprehension, created all of humanity, created you? And either life is about you and what you want to do and what you make of it, and you're the captain of your own soul and the captain of your own fate, or this life is about nothing more than having a loving relationship with the one who created you that you can enjoy for all eternity. It's about one or the other. And you've got to make a decision what your life is all about. You've got to make a decision of what fuels your life. Because every other decision you make is going to flow out of that. If you continue with the first choice, that this life is all about me, he says every other thing that's going to come out of that is going to be futile. That's why you start New Year's resolutions and you quit them. I think, was it 2-3 days ago, it was National Quitters Day? Anybody know that? Why is it National Quitters Day? It's not because that's the day we decide we're going to quit something. That's because that's the day everybody quits their New Year's resolution. Because they last about 10 to 15 days on average. Because if I'm not going to change who I am, and I'm not going to change what I center my life around, then my decision to stop smoking or be a better person or whatever it is, isn't going to happen. Because at the end of the day, my body comes back and says, feed me, Seymour, feed me. Feed me, right? Give me what I want. I want it now. Forget all that exercise stuff. Who cares if you just spent $30 on a membership and signed up? We ain't doing that no more. My body wants to go home and sleep because it's dark out, right? If I don't change who I am and what this life is all about and what I think is really going on here, then all these other decisions aren't going to matter. So it first has to make a decision, but the decision that matters is a decision of what this life is really all about. He says, you've got to put off your old way of thinking, this futile way of thinking, what you thought life was all about, and put on the new self that was, he goes, created to be like God. There it goes. You're created. God created you with an intentional purpose. You've got to go and put on the new self of what you were created to be and accept that. Now, while that decision is being made, in the middle of that, you'll notice he says, to put off, and then the next verse it starts off, it says, and be made new, and then the next verse says, and put on. Do you notice that in there? It's kind of like it almost interrupts it. Like, originally I was reading this, it's like, you know, it would have been better ordered if you just said put off, then put on, then I could go on to point number two, which would be the next verse, and say be made new. That would have been a lot easier, I think, for me to break the text down. But unfortunately, it's right in the middle. But it's intentional. Because what he's showing here is there's the tense of the verbs change, both in who's doing the action and how long the action is. So the tense of the put off and put on is this is a decision you're making that you just make. I'm doing this. This life is about nothing more than a loving relationship with Jesus Christ and that I can enjoy for all eternity. It is not about me. It is not about what I want. And God's not called to be my assistant. He's my Lord and he's my King. That's a decision I make. I put off my old way of thinking and I put that on. And while that is happening, while I'm putting that off and putting that on, while I'm making that decision, it says, be made new. That is a passive thing. It's God doing that in you. God is making you new from the inside. He is making you new. He's giving you a new attitude in your mind. He is changing your mind. When you change and say, this is what my life is all about, he begins to work in you. And this is an ongoing process where he is changing, renewing, transforming. Maybe some of y'all can even call to mind some verses that talk about this, where God is working inside you to change the way you see things, change the way you think about things. And we talked last week a little bit about how it's a slow process. And this happened. God works in you. You'll see this kind of language over in Philippians chapter 2. It says, continue to work out your salvation that he is working in you. Continue to work out. It's not like let go, let God. It's you make the decision and God's also at work. You can't just say, God, do it, and I'm not going to make a decision. And you can't just make a decision and not expect God to do anything there. That there's both things happening at the same time. When change is going to happen, you've made a decision about what you're going to order your life around, and God's also at work behind the scenes working in you. And so both of those things are working together. And then you get to the becoming more like Christ. The motivation has to be to become more like Christ, because when it's not, at some point the motivation is going to break down. Most change motivation is very self-serving. Most change motivation can be narrowed down to one of two categories, either fear or pride. Think about with kids, you know, son, don't lie. If you lie, you're only going to make things worse. Like, at least in our household, we double the consequences for a lie, right? So if you did something wrong, that's a consequence. But if you lie about it, we double the consequence. Is that right? Anybody send me all with me on that? Like, so if you would lose your electronic devices for a week for what you did, well, if you lie to me about it, well, now you've just lost them for 2 weeks. That's the way. So I'm basically using fear to get you to conform to the right morality, right? That's right. So it's fear-based. There's also, you can use pride. I don't want you to be a liar. I don't want you to be given the stigma. Do you want to be known as a liar? Do you want to be somebody that people can't trust? Is that the kind of person you want to be? That's not who we are. That's not how we raised you. That's not our family. You know, what you're doing reflects on me. I mean, you need to take pride in who you are. And you need to think about the kind of person you want to be, right? Anybody use this kind of language? And basically what we're saying is, you know, you're a good person, and that's beneath you to act like that. That's not like you. Now, while those look like good motivations, at the end of the day, they're both self-serving motivations, right? One, I'm trying to avoid consequences, and the other one, I'm just making myself feel better about who I am. Well, at some point, a self-serving motivation is going to self-serve you to not do the end result, right? At some point, you're going to see that it really is in your best interest to lie, to cheat, to embezzle, to have an affair, something like this. Something's going to come up where you realize, I'm not going to get caught, and it's in my best interest to lie about this right now. And so the whole outward motivation at some point is going to break down. It's no different for Christians. You know, you need to be a good Christian. Why? Well, out of fear. You don't want to go to hell, do you? You wouldn't want that to happen to you. Or for even Christians who that's not their motivation, it's like, well, you don't want to go on God's bad side. I mean, you know, God's going to get you for what you did, so you better make sure you're doing the right thing or else God's going to get you. And then there's the pride. Well, I'm a little better than other people, and that's just not what I do because I'm a Christian. And so we have this sense of pride about us, and you've come in contact with these kinds of Christians before. Maybe in your mind we still move back to these kinds of thinkings at somewhere. If your motivation is anything other than a loving relationship with Christ, it's going to break down at some point. It's got to be something beyond yourself. It's got to be where you get to the point where you say, I don't want to do this because I don't want to hurt God in that sense. It's sort of like, is your motivation for not cheating on your spouse because you love your spouse and you would never want to hurt them and bring that upon them, or is it, you know, something in the sense of, I don't want to be known as a cheater, or I don't want to get caught, or any of those kind of things? You know, one's going to move you one direction, one's going to move you another direction eventually at some point. You've got to get to this point over here where you see it for what it is. And the person who changes is the person who begins to see, this is not about me. And then even the greater motivation is, I wouldn't want to do that because of Christ. I remember I had this conversation years ago. This lady in our church needed something fixed, and she's like, yeah, just come over anytime. I'm in the shower right now. You can just come on and leave the door open. I'm like, nope, not going over there. And this thing like slipped out of my mouth, which was just sort of really odd. And I said that this is back with Melissa. And I said, she's like, whoa. She's like, well, something came up. I said, listen, I want her to know Jesus far more than I want to sleep with her. She's like, what about me? And I was trying to like, yeah, that's a part of it, but isn't this a greater motivation? She couldn't see it. It was kind of an odd moment. I just, I don't know. Maybe I'm still wrong. I don't know. Maybe I'm still trying to justify myself. I want to conclude out with this last thought. You might ask, you know, why is the process of change so hard? Why can't I just pray a prayer and have God snap his fingers? I love a story out of the Screwtape Letters. It's a book by C.S. Lewis. It takes a little while to get your mind wrapped around it. The Screwtape Letters is a hypothetical, in today's term, it'd be like an email back and forth that you're reading between two demons who are trying to tempt and infect and lead astray this guy. And so in the Screwtape letters, when they talk about the enemy, they're talking about Jesus. When they're talking about the patient, they're talking about somebody like you. And so in chapter 2, what happens in the end of chapter 1 is the guy gets saved, and they're all freaking out, like, oh, no, this guy's now accepting Jesus. Like, hey, all's not lost here. We still got a plan even for this thing. And so he says, work hard then on the disappointment, which is certainly to come on this patient during the first few weeks they become a churchgoer. So they're going to go to church and be all excited about it. But within a couple weeks, they're going to have a letdown experience. Jesus allows them to have this disappointment to occur on the threshold of every human endeavor. It occurs when the child who grew up in the church, enchanted by all the nursery stories from the Bible, begins to buckle down and learn Greek and Hebrew and struggle through that exercise. It occurs when lovers who have gotten married begin the real task of learning to live together. In every department of life, it marks a transition from this dreaming aspiration to the laborious nature of the doing. Jesus takes this risk because he has this curious fantasy of making all these disgusting human vermin into what he calls free lovers and servants. He calls them sons and daughters with this peculiar habit of loving them. During their freedom, he therefore refuses to carry them by mere affections and habits to any goals that he sets before them. He leaves them to, in a sense, do it on their own. And therein lies our opportunity. But remember, therein also lies a danger. If once they get through this initial dryness successfully, they'll become much less dependent on emotion and therefore much harder to tempt. What he's talking about there is when you first become a Christian, oftentimes you're on this, euphoric spiritual high and you want to do all the right things and you want to do all these wonderful things because you're just, so excited about your new relationship, but pretty soon that wears off. And he says, now here's the issue. You have to get to them right then, because if they get through that and they cultivate a lasting, loving, growing, deepening relationship with God that then begins to motivate them from within, and they're not based on emotion where they're only doing good for the sake of a crisis, or they're only doing good to get them through a momentary issue, or they're only doing good because they're on a spiritual high, if you get them to the point where they've cultivated a deep-seated love for Christ, you've lost them. You've lost them. And the goal for you and for I, if you're going to change anything this year, you've got to begin with, what's my life all about? What am I living for? Have the conversation, to what degree is selfishness affecting me? And I guarantee you, you're not going to like what you hear. You won't, because that's the hardness of your heart coming out. But if you're going to make a change this year, it's got to start there. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the gift of a new year. I thank you that we get to truly turn the page, not just in our calendar, but in our life. I thank you that each and every week that we come in, we are reminded that each week is a new week, that we turn the page. We come together on Sunday, the start of a new week. We share together in communion as a reminder that what you did on the cross is taking care of our past. It's taking care of this past week, our failures this past year, our failures at any time in our life. So, Father, we thank you for this continual reminder of the gift, of the opportunity of a new week. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.